Hello, you're listening to The Games Press, a podcast series in which I interview interesting people from across the video games media about their lives and their work. Today's guest is one of my favourite YouTubers, and you might have started to suspect that I'm just using this show as an excuse to speak to people that I admire, and you'd be absolutely right in that suspicion. His name is Jacob Galler, and he's a video essayist who quite simply makes me care more about the games that I play. Whereas Mark Brown, another fantastic video essayist we had on the podcast a couple of months ago, specialises in game design and picking apart mechanics, Jacob's work is all about feelings. His videos have made me cry more than once and remain a vital source when it comes to being able to repeat clever things that he's said in order for me to sound a little smarter in conversation. A quick word before we begin about our sponsor. The Games Press is once again brought to you with the help of our friends at Loading. Now, if you've ever been to the south of England, and honestly, you should, it's really not as bad as people say, you're likely already familiar with the two gaming bars they operate in either East London or Brighton. And they're about to open a third place as well in Peckham's Mountview Academy, and they're great venues full of free-to-play board games and video games, as long as you grab a drink or a bit of food first, that is. Don't take the piss, come on. And we'd like to thank them for sponsoring this podcast. And now, Jacob Galler. Hello, Jacob Galler. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Yours is one of those names that I feel quite uncomfortable not saying in full. Like I said, Jacob, before we started this podcast, and it just, I think because I always see your channel name, it just didn't feel right. It has to be Jacob Galler.
That's right. I've made it kind of my company title as well as just my normal name. so yeah, there are some people who call me Jake in real life, and there are more people who call me Jacob, and then online, everyone calls me Jacob Galler now.
Whoa, I hadn't even considered the possibility that you could be a Jake. That's right. Okay, that's interesting. Well, I'll try and build up to Jacob. I'll see how I get on throughout the course of this. So I had no idea until I started prepping for this interview that you either have or at least had very recently a whole other job completely separate to the YouTube stuff.
That is true. I still have it.
Can you describe what that job is?
Yeah, I don't want to give too many specifics because it is kind of like a normal person job, but I'm a research assistant. I work at a small research company that does kind of like educational stuff.
How are you still doing that and also this? Because you have a pretty consistent schedule for the videos that come out. To me, you look like you're doing it full time. Yeah, particularly right now with People Make Games, we've just hit like a difficult story for various like logistical reasons that slowed us down a little, and it's making me feel real inferior by comparison to know that you're running both of those things at the same time.
I guess thank you first of all. I do work on being consistent, but no, I mean I think part of the reason that I can do both is because the other job that I have. You know, I think I do a good job at and whatever. It's not the most kind of stressful, time-consuming thing. Like, there are periods that I'm really busy with it, and there are other periods that I'm not as much. And we'll talk about in advance, I work really far in advance on things. Like my videos are often done a long time before they come out, and part of the reason that I do that is just if something comes up in one side or the other, I've kind of given myself that time. But also, I do work a lot of hours, and I probably could quit the other job at this point. But one, I care about it. Like, it's, you know, it is work that I think is good to be doing. And also, having a job on YouTube is scary, as you might know. And so even though I'm, you know, probably as set up as one could be in this space, it still feels really precarious to be like, all right, so long, health insurance. I'm ready to, you know, fully support myself on Patreon now. It's just like a really scary jump to take.
Let's talk for a second about the something you just mentioned, which is that you work a few videos in advance and that you have this stuff sort of stocked and ready to go ahead of pressing publish. That's not really how we work over here. It's something that we would love to be doing more of, particularly Like Annie, who does all the illustration and animation sides of People Make Games, will sometimes need to wait for the reporting side of things to get done before she can start on her side of the job in earnest. And that can like be quite stressful for both of us, depending like if the reporting hits any sort of speed bumps. We would love to be doing that. I think it would make sense. The idea of it also seems really stressful to me. I think because I've worked on YouTube for quite a long time, and prior to People Make Games, they were on video teams with like daily uploads and things like that. The idea of sitting on a video, having it ready to go, and not getting it up as quickly as possible fills me with a strange kind of anxiety. Do you have that at all, or have you managed to sort of figure that out?
No, I totally do. I mean, I think part of the reason that I am able to do this is I'm really a one-person operation. You know, like I do work with other people. There's a hot cider on Twitter, someone who like makes my thumbnails. I've recently had started working with kind of audio people because I know very little about audio, but like really it's like I'm writing, I'm editing. I very seldom require sources other than mm-hmm. just kind of like research that I'm already doing, but like I'm not reporting like you are, and so I don't need to like wait on someone to do an interview usually, and so that just lets me kind of work as much as I want. And something that I like about this, but also something that could definitely become a problem in the future, is I enjoy being able to like I really need to feel productive almost every day. You know, like I have just something in my brain that's like, if I haven't done anything today, I just can't kind of sit on the couch or do something. Like I have this drive to need to keep going. And with every other job I've had, it has been really stressful for me to like wait on people to approve things or whatever. And so with this, the fact that I can just put as many hours into it as I want at whatever times I want is kind of appealing. And yeah, sitting on stuff is stressful. I mean, when I first started my channel, I was just so kind of thrilled with the ability to write and edit things and whatever that I was releasing a video every 2 weeks. And I was just like, it was like I would do it, and as soon as it was done, I would hit publish and put it up, and like they would go from there. And eventually it was kind of like, wouldn't it be cool if I built in a little buffer for myself, so even if I finish in 2 weeks, I release in 3 weeks? And I've kind of moved forward from there in giving myself this buffer, because you probably also experience this. I also have this fear of just like, what if I don't have another thing? Mm-hmm. You know, like the kinds of videos that I make, there's really not like a formula for them. I can't just be like, well, you know, Deathloop is popular, so obviously I'll make a Deathloop video, because there are just so many different things that I'm usually trying to connect, and I find it really hard to write about something if I'm not passionate about it. And so part of the reason that I work ahead is I have this constant fear of just, if I don't have anything, I'm gonna need a couple weeks to just like read a bunch of stuff or play a bunch of stuff and try to get another idea.
Okay, now that makes more sense to me, that fear is part of that driving
yes,
like force. I totally get it now. Cool. Well, I want to come back to some of what you just said in a little bit, but first of all, can we go back to sort of mid-2018, which is when you interned with Game Informer for a few mm-hmm. months? I don't know if we've had anyone on the podcast so far that's done like an internship with a games media company. I don't think so. Anyway, what was that like? Was that a good experience?
Yeah, it was. I mean, so it was kind of an interesting thing going in, because I really was not doing that internship with the kind of idea that like, this is going to get me into games writing, this is going to be mm-hmm. my gateway into a job. It was truly more like, I'm working at kind of a boring job that I can take time off. Like, I was working at a restaurant, and so I could mm-hmm. just kind of say, I'm not working for these couple months. And I just felt like if I didn't do this, I would regret it later on when I was working an office job and had never, you know, wrote about games semi-professionally, which was something that I had been reading forever. And so, yeah, and so I did, and it was a great time, but it still wasn't, I didn't come out of it being, like, time to apply to games writing jobs.
Yep.
It was more just, like, this is a cool thing, and I have published work that I can show to, again, some office that I would, you know, probably be, like, writing news articles for or whatever.
Yeah, because that's the internship was, from what I can tell, like, mostly writing news, like, quick turnaround news with the ability for you to, like, pitch, like, bigger things here and there, right?
Yep.
Like, looking at the kind of work that you do, I imagine the latter part of that is kind of more what you were interested in.
Yeah, I appreciated writing news. I mean, I feel like it kind of helped me figure out how to write a headline, which is something important and just kind of various things. But yeah, if you look at that time, I was kind of hilariously productive as an intern, whereas just like every day I would be coming to the editors being like, all right, can I write about best gaming foods? And they'd be like, all right, I don't, like, whatever, we're not paying you, so go ahead. And yeah, it was just another kind of like testing the waters. Like, I guess I do have enough about games to say that I could like keep up this level of, you know, I didn't run out of things to write about that summer.
I think there were a couple of interesting things that you wrote that I wanted to highlight. First of all, you talked about this wasn't a news article, but in terms of headlines is incredible, which is, I played all of Shrek and Beat Saber and it nearly killed me, which is, to be clear, Shrek the movie, not like just the musical aspects of mm-hmm. it, which is what, like 2 hours?
Yeah, it's like a 2 hour, yeah, however long that movie is, including, you know, the dance party at the credits and all of that.
Yeah, I feel like that could have existed on the Jacob Geller YouTube channel. It maybe didn't have the "this is what we've learned about humanity" sort of aspect to
right.
it.
Right. That was the first place that I had ever tried VR. And so basically the whole summer I was like, please let me write about Beat Saber. Like, I need to write about this game. And they were like, VR articles just don't go anywhere. Like, no one reads them or whatever. And so finally, that was like my last day that I was there. I like found this angle and I was like, this is undeniably clickable. Like, yeah. Even if people don't care about the game, this is just too absurd.
The other one I thought was interesting is that you wrote a feature about YouTubers that were in the gaming space making a living through Patreon, and like what that experience is like, how it's sort of changing what kind of gaming video is being made on YouTube. And you spoke to people like Mark Brown, who's been on this podcast already. I just found it very interesting to see you writing about that maybe like a year or so before you have your own setup.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it had been something I loved these video essays for a long time, you know, for longer than I had been writing about games or whatever. And really, I was interested in that topic, but I was also interested in having an email that ended with gameinformer.com, because it meant that I could basically write to anyone and they would respond, which is not definitely an experience that you have otherwise. And so it was this really fun chance to be like, I could talk to, you know, Mark Brown and Ian Danskin and these people who I was like just admired so much in the space, and kind of having a reason to contact them professionally was very exciting for me.
I think that's one of the best parts about journalism in general, is having that excuse to get in touch with interesting people about interesting things.
Right.
Yeah, so you finish up at Game Informer after a few months and start writing some more like personal video game essays around that time, I think.
I had done a couple before I started as well. But yeah, there's a podcast that I used to work with called Kane and Rince that would, mm-hmm. you know, publish these kind of personal blogs. And so I, yeah, went back and started doing that.
And those became some of your first scripts, right? For the mm-hmm. first video essays that you end up publishing. So as someone who like used to be, in your own words, very insecure about recording your voice and letting other people on the internet hear it, what prompted that decision? Was it just the fact that you were looking at these video essays thinking that is a cool thing that I would like to be a part of? But how did you get over that initial I don't like recording myself. I don't like that. Doesn't feel natural to me at all.
Yeah, it's there were several things. I mean, one that I've said before, but really is the truth, is just I love the emotive power of music so much, and I really wished while writing things, like sometimes I would even put in notes on a blog, like, hey, if you listen to this song while you read this blog, I think it's gonna like work a lot better. And so I just wanted the ability to add music. And video was a way to do that. Obviously, I did, you know, admire people who were doing these things. And there was also just the, you know, the kind of issue of a reach of, like, if you're writing a blog, and especially, I mean, even a blog for, like, a well-known outlet, but especially if you're just kind of posting it privately, there's just no room for it to be found. You know, you can tweet about it once, and maybe your friends will read it or whatever. But there is no such thing as an algorithm for just, like, Blogspot. And so I did genuinely want these videos to, or I wanted the things that I was writing to be consumed by more people. And it seemed like videos were just kind of the way to do that. And so all of those things together, I was like, all right, well, I'll try to get over my my voice thing.
Are you over it these days?
Yeah, I think hilariously, if you listen to my first videos, like, my voice sounds so different. Just kind of like the tone, or maybe it doesn't to other people, but it does to me. And I can really tell, like, how much I'm kind of trying to do a thing versus now where I feel like I can more or less just talk.
So yeah, you start reusing some of those scripts, reusing some of those articles, turning them into scripts, and you're publishing your first video essays, hoping to, like, you know, achieve some kind of reach with them that you might not be able to do with a normal blog. Did it work? Like, these days, obviously, your videos get watched by hundreds of thousands of people. But what was the audience like back then with those first few uploads? How did people find your work? How many people found it? What was that like?
Yeah, I mean, the first one was pretty thrilling for me, because the first you know, video that I put up was about labor and Night in the Woods and Tacoma. And I'm pretty sure, yeah, Scott Benson retweeted it. And he has, you know, at the time he had like 60,000 followers, and I'm sure he has more now. But that was like, oh, look, I'm already getting kind of platformed in the way that I hoped. Like, this, you know, this wouldn't happen with just a blog or whatever. And so that got, like, you know, 700 views, and it was really exciting.
Where are those first 700 coming from? Is that from, did you have like a Twitter presence at that point because of like bits and pieces you've been doing?
I had some Twitter because I had already written for Game Informer at that point, and so there are some people who just followed that. I mean, and yeah, I think a lot of people just seeing, you know, me tagging Night in the Woods or whatever, and like that being seen. Maybe I had a few subscribers left over from when I did Minecraft videos. I don't know. But it did just kind of feel like, oh, there are people like showing up here. And a really cool thing that happened almost immediately was there were other, you know, very small but content producing video people who kind of reached out and was like, hey, here's a Discord with other people who have, you know, less than 1,000 subscribers or whatever. And so even if there wasn't like a huge audience, I felt like I got to be in the community a little bit. And that was very exciting.
And did you end up having a particular like breakout moment? I think the first time I became aware of your channel was when you published Judaism and Whiteness and Wolfenstein, I think. Or maybe it might well have been the Shadow of the Colossus video, which is like, I know went properly viral. It's kind of hard to remember because I've watched a lot of your stuff out of order. But was there a particular day where something changed and your channel did find this larger audience?
Yeah, I mean, it absolutely was the Shadow of the Colossus video. Like, there, I had been slowly building an audience, and it is fascinating to me that I think some of my best known videos now, like the Wolfenstein one or the Modern Art one, were published before my breakout. But it's like, I think I had somewhere close to 3,000 subscribers before the Shadow of the Colossus one came out. And at the end of that month, I had like 70,000. Like, it was really, it was that immediate of a jump. I've really, like, I have never seen, I've never had something algorithmed like that again. And it's really hard for me to even think of another video that's kind of been punched that hard from such a small channel.
How did you find that moment? Because I've heard Philosophy Tube has talked about the fact that she's almost quite grateful that the channel never had like an explosion moment, that it's grown in a reasonably linear way, because it gives you a bit more room to make some of the early mistakes or to sort of find the voice that you want. How did it feel going from like 3,000 subscribers to like that video was everywhere? It felt like it. Is that an entirely positive experience? Yeah. What happens?
I think it was very positive. One of the things that that made that experience good for me in a way that I think it could easily have not been is I saw people start to go back to my earlier videos. Like, and almost parallel with the Shadow of the Colossus one, my one on Super Mario Galaxy started kind of exploding, where it was like enough people watched that after the Colossus one that it started to also kind of get its own momentum in the algorithm, and so people were like, oh wow, look at all this good stuff, like I can't believe, you know, there's like a year's worth of videos there that people could go back and see. And it did mean that, like, when I released my Wolfenstein video to, you know, 2,000 subs or whatever, no one was shitty about it, because, you know, there were like 1,500 people who watched it, and they were all pretty clearly like, yeah, I subscribed to this channel who started talking about labor unions, like, yep. I know where he stands politically. And as more people saw it, there were more just like Nazis in the comments or whatever, which was the kind of shitty. But overall, I felt like I had already figured out my voice, and so that was positive. That if that happened on like my second video, I might have been like, oh gosh, I guess I have to pivot to like a secrets focused channel or something, like trying to emulate the success. But since I already had, you know, 20 essays up at that point,
felt like you knew what you're doing.
I kind of felt like I know what I'm doing, and now, you know, people are getting to see what I have been doing, and it seems like they like it.
Did it do anything weird to your brain in the fact that YouTube, even more now actually in 2021 than back then, really knows how to sort of celebrate those moments where you go viral? It in fact, I must have talked about this already, but like these days, like if you one of your videos is a breakout hit, you literally get confetti on your main sort of creator screen on the back end. I remember when we had like one of our first sort of videos to go somewhat viral, which was the Queen's Golden Wii video that we did. I couldn't help but like set myself up for failure with the next piece. Like, oh my God, we need to achieve that kind of success again. Or like, if the next video isn't popular, does that mean that like, oh my God, are we just like a one hit wonder? And I ran through some of that kind of stuff, which was not a great thing to do to your sort of mental health and your relationship between your own self-worth and creative output. I wondered, is anything like that happen with you when you had this like big moment of success where that blows up and then some of your older videos start doing better? Like, how did you feel come the next upload?
Yeah, well, it was weird. I mean, one thing that happened around that time is like I had very intentionally not set up a Patreon, and like my channel wasn't monetized, and it was just kind of like, I'm making these videos because it's fun, and I think if I attach a money component to it, especially when, like, I knew that if I set up a Patreon before then, I would have been, you know, pulling in $50 a video or whatever, and I've just been like, that amount of money is not worth the stress that it would give me to know that I was, like, financially beholden to people. And so I hadn't monetized in any way. And then after that video, there was this moment of like, okay, the amount of money that I am giving up by not having something here is too much to ignore. You know, like it's not, the scales have shifted to the other side where before I didn't want to, you know, kind of have any buy-in or whatever. And now it was like, I know for every day that I'm not doing this, I'm missing out on a really significant amount of like ad revenue or whatever. And so I did set that up. But yeah, it was weird. And I kind of didn't know how much to expect from that. And I, you know, it is kind of strange to have this like giant breakout and not attach a way for people to pay you for it, and then kind of trying to go back later and being like, hey, if you like that,
hey, that thing over there, remember?
Yeah. You know, it's, I don't know. I do remember feeling a lot of pressure after it. And then as it happens, the next video that I released was the one on haunted houses, which still might be the best video I've ever made. Right. And so like it really, you know, I have a really hard time knowing how a video will be received before it comes out. And so I wasn't like, this is the best video I've ever made. But to have this big breakout success and then follow it up with one that was kind of a critical darling, like that was the first time that I had the kind of like games industry people saying like, hey, I really like this, it did make me feel like, okay, I wasn't a one-hit wonder. Like I can keep doing this. But there were definitely, I mean, it's like, you know, I had things where I'd get a notification for every comment, and like it took so long for me to turn that off because I did get kind of addicted to the little like endorphin, just like here's a notification, and eventually I was like, I am dying, like I need to not have this on.
Jacob, how do you come up with the topics for your videos? Because there's at least two parts of your process that I find scarily impressive. The first one being like the comparisons you make end up being so varied. Like one moment you're connecting Dark Souls 3 with I'm Thinking of Ending Things, which are two experiences I don't think I'd ever have drawn together without your help. And then in another video, you'll be like, hey, remember Roller Coaster Tycoon? Let's talk about a hypothetical euthanasia coaster designed by a Lithuanian artist. How do you find these links to make in your work? And I guess as a second follow-up, which we also touched on at the beginning, like how are you doing it so consistently? Like those are the bits about what you do that I don't really get.
Yeah, well, the scary answer is I don't know. And so it feels like it's hard to ensure that will happen in the future. I mean, I think there is sometimes when I read comments or get correspondence, I think people have a picture of me as someone who is just constantly, you know, like reads like six books a week and whatever, and it's like kind of consuming so much material that I have something for everything. And that's not the case. And I think it is more just that like I am good at connecting the dots between things I already like. You know, that I think of things, and especially kind of pieces of art or storytelling or whatever, much more tonally than actual, you know, plot. And so like, you know, with Dark Souls 3 and I'm Thinking of Ending Things, the connection for me wasn't, oh, this is about a cycle of world ending and whatever. It was just kind of like, these two things make me feel kind of the same way. And right. Then exploring why that is often, you know, results in like the points of the video or whatever. But I feel like I have a pretty good kind of sense memory for art where I can just kind of hold on to the way that I felt while experiencing something. And so then just kind of putting those things together is where it comes from. And I am at this point, I'm also pretty good at seeing a summary of something and thinking like that's gonna do what I want. Yep. You know, like with the book Piranesi, which I read before writing that Infinity video, like, you know, I read the dust jacket to that book and I was like, oh, this is gonna do it for me. Or like, you know, before I started playing Before Your Eyes, I was like, I'm pretty confident that this is going to have something there. Yeah,
that's it. Interesting. There's some comparisons with what you've just said, with how I asked a similar question to Mark Brown actually, but more on less to do with like the feeling of something and more to do with like how he remembers all these game mechanics across this huge backlog of things that he's played. And yeah, the two of you just, you reminded me of him then in the way that you managed to store that in the right place that you can access it again fairly easily.
I had once when I was a kid, I was just like spouting some, it was like my friend's dad brought up a movie and I like hadn't seen the movie, but I had read like a trivia thing on it. And so I was like, oh, did you know that, like, you know, Tom Hanks in that movie did this? And he was like, you're an encyclopedia of useless, interesting bullshit. And I feel like I've like found the kind of one job where it's like, that can be my job, is just to like retain all these pieces of information.
Just to prove that guy wrong. I love it. Mm-hmm. So I mentioned your Wolfenstein video before, which is this like 30-minute exploration of the Jewish experience in America pre and post World War II. It's incredible. So eye-opening to watch as a non-Jewish person. More recently, you've published a piece called The Golem and the Jewish Superhero, which is a beautiful celebration of Jewish folklore. Now, those two videos are obviously very, very clear examples of your Judaism affecting your work. Well, I also read in an interview that you did earlier on with Jewish Boston, in which you spoke about how the text is never just the text, or I guess to put it more bluntly, like how your relationship with Judaism taught you some of the necessary skills to be a good critic. Can you talk me through that a little bit?
Yeah, so I think, I mean, I should, you know, kind of preface this by saying Judaism means a lot of different things to different people. So like, I'm talking about kind of my personal experience here and not necessarily everyone. But one of the things that has always been really central to Judaism for me and how kind of my family, you know, raised me and talked about it and whatever is like, there is this constant sense of interrogation, you know, of the text. Like, you know, if you go to high holy day services like Yom Kippur or Rosh Hashanah, at least at a Reform synagogue, odds are there is going to be a rabbi talking about how dumb of a decision it was for Abraham to have, you know, considered sacrificing Isaac, you know, at the time. And it's this very kind of, the Torah is sacred, like the text is sacred, but it's not part of the way that you are supposed to draw meaning, holiness, whatever, out of that is just by kind of tearing it apart. And there is this kind of trope that is very true, I think, of Jews kind of arguing about everything. And that argument is kind of loving and shows really, you know, that you are thinking deeply about things that other people are saying and whatever. And so it's, you know, it's kind of not accepting anything at face value. And I've said before, one of the things that I really like about Judaism is, like, I'm not a particularly godly person. Like, I don't think about God that much. But you can still kind of do everything in Judaism, whether or not that's a big part, because the central tenets are not believe in God and live your life that way. It's just kind of like, you know, figure out what this means to you and how you can help it, how it can help you live as a good person. And so, yeah, it was always just, you know, I felt like my parents were constantly asking me to think about things that I had watched and read. And certainly not all of those were religious, but it all feels like it kind of stems from this really kind of Jewish curiosity and critical eye.
Yeah, I like the sort of loving interrogation of a text. So have you found that you, like, even in your younger years, that's something that you you did with the games that you were playing and the other like media you interacted with? Is that conversations with friends? Is it like online? Like how does that come about?
My parents were really not into the idea of games at all. And so a lot of my kind of early experience with games was like arguing to them that this is art and this has meaning in a way that will be very familiar to people who now watch my channel. But it was just like, Mom, you have to let me, you know, buy a PS2 so I can play Shadow of the Colossus because this is a seminal piece of art and here's my checklist of why it matters.
How convincing do you think you were in those moments?
It worked, you know. I think it was pretty good. You know, and I definitely talked to friends about it. I think I got a subscription to Game Informer before I had a game console, you know, that I really just loved reading about people writing about these things. And because games were, this is now kind of a criticism I have of games writing, but, you know, when I was a kid, you know, getting really into film criticism felt almost completely unapproachable because they were, you know, so kind of steeped in the history already. And games just felt more like, I can figure all this out. You know, they're writing about Max like the previous 20 years, and that's much more manageable. Yeah, so as a kid, I loved that I felt like I could get in on the ground floor of these things and kind of, you know, feel like I understood what the writer was writing about, but was still learning to kind of, you know, look at these things in a new light. Now, I wish... It's hard because I don't want to take that away from me as a child, but I also do wish that that games writing would kind of interact with its own history more.
What do you mean when you think they should engage with their history more? Like, what kind of examples are you talking about?
This is like a hot topic, but you know, there was recently that that article on ludonarrative dissonance that came out, and there are a lot of people on Twitter, you know, mostly kind of older people who are like, we've had this conversation so many times, you know, why are we rehashing this? And, you know, and I think there are solid arguments for both. Actually, it's good to bring this up, you know, every 5 years or so, because there are a whole new generation of people who haven't interacted with this, but also kind of saying, hey, in 2012, when we were talking about this, this is what we all thought about it. And in the time since, you know, this conversation has actually kept evolving. And so now you can see where we are now, rather than kind of just treating it like it's starting fresh every time. You know, there's this thing of like, people do so much work writing and kind of trying to define terms and what they mean and what their use is. And then that sort of gets thrown away. And I do think part of the problem with that in games is that one of the most, you know, prominent versions of writing is reviews, which is something that you don't do in conversation with other people and are, you know, like, they just come out once and then they exist forever and they don't change. And that's just not a great way to kind of build up a discourse. I think people haven't been shown why they should care about this history yet, you know, and that is partly our job to say, like, it's important that you know this term, not just because you can throw it around, but because, you know, by knowing this and knowing the conversations that have happened previously about it, you can expand your knowledge of games. Like, you can make these things more meaningful for yourself if you engage in a little study. But that's, you know, that's just a hard sell when people are like, I just want to know if this is good or not. Like, those reviews are infinitely more readable than ones that try to engage with, you know, a decade or more of conversations about this topic.
Now, your videos often like deeply, intensely personal. It's not necessarily that you share more of your personal life than other critics or other YouTubers, but you're very transparent and articulate about how things make you feel. Does that emotional vulnerability that you're tapping into lead to more like parasocial relationships being formed with your audience, do you think? Because people feel like they know you and that you know them.
Probably yes. You know, I do think that people kind of have this sense of what the kind of Jacob Geller brand is, and like it's not inaccurate, you know, like although I am certainly kind of doing a persona, you know, when I make these videos, like I'm not saying things that I don't feel ever. Like I am always kind of honest when I'm writing things, because I don't, like, I just can't write about stuff if not. I can't kind of fake it. I do think that the people who watch my videos know the term parasocial relationship and, right, and are often pretty cognizant of it, which I appreciate, you know, whereas like they might have conversations about like, oh, I feel like this guy's my friend, but don't so often message me in that way. Yeah, I think I've been fairly kind of sheltered from the really negative parts of that. I mean, a lot of that is I am like a white guy. You know, I think if I was a woman and this open emotionally, I would get a lot grosser comments about it. And so, you know, I think that I'm kind of in the easiest position that I could be for dealing with this. But mostly, you know, the kind of feedback that I get that I appreciate is people just saying like, hey, you helped me realize that I can also be more in touch with my emotions while playing something or, you know, experiencing art or whatever. And that's what I want. You know, that's the biggest kind of compliment.
Do you ever have to think twice about how much of yourself you put into your videos? Or do you try to resist even thinking about that? Like, what are there? Yeah. How much of your sort of creative process when you're writing it is you trying to be aware of not crossing certain lines or holding back where you need to?
Yes, I definitely do think about it. I think that partially, as you kind of stated, the openness or the vulnerability in my videos does not come from saying like, hey, here are my parents, this is my address or whatever, but just kind of saying like, this is how I felt in a very openly emotional way. And that feels less dangerous to me. Like, I don't think that letting people know, you know, the ways that my emotions kind of vary has the potential to really backfire in the way that just like sharing too much of your life does. But I certainly do. And I mean, you know, I've definitely thought about like in the Judaism videos or whatever that like I'm gonna be the most prominent Jewish person that a lot of these people have heard from, and maybe they've never talked to a Jew before, and so now I'm representing this big thing that I'm not qualified to do. I absolutely do think about that just in kind of like my position as it's hilarious to say influencer, but like literally just like someone who influences thought for people. You know, if you don't have other people talking about golems in your life, then like this guy's take is going to become the take. And so there is a lot of weight attached to anything that I'm saying connected to that.
Have you ever felt like you've got that wrong? Like that you look back at a video where you're like, oh, I feel like that was expressed in the wrong way, or that I like wish I could go back and sort of take another stab of how that's represented? Like, how often does that come up?
Not often. There is, it's a weird thing because it's just a weird video overall, even though it's one that I'm very proud of. But I have that one about just kind of like school architecture and how it resembles a level design in that like it's a place that's preparing to be gun to have gunfire in it, and what a kind of disturbing concept that is. And I'm really proud of that video. I think that video is good, but it's also very weird to see comments there that are like, this is why I've been saying we need to give every teacher a gun. And like the idea that someone could come out of that video and think that, like, not only think that that's a good idea, but probably think that I agree with them that, like, we should arm teachers or, like, put more cops in school or whatever is kind of disturbing for me. And so there's always this tightrope of, like, I like leaving things open, and I like kind of ushering people towards conclusions rather than, like, pointing them out directly and saying, this is what I think. But especially for topics in which people are already so dug into, you know, not making your point super explicit does have this danger of people kind of using it in the wrong way. Or I've seen with the Wolfenstein people, or the Wolfenstein people, the Wolfenstein video, I've seen people citing, like, how I talk about changing racialization as a reason why, like, actually, you know, when Irish people came here, they had it just as bad as black people or whatever, which is not the case and not something that I, like, wanted to communicate. And so it's, I don't think there's been a situation where I'm like, I didn't communicate that clearly enough, and more just kind of the terror of having something that you made taken out of your hands is always kind of hard to get used to. Like, the, you know, recent video had me talking about, like, colonialism and whatever, and sometimes people comment, like, oh, I like your videos, but I hate when you get political. And then, much to my satisfaction, I always see comments under that that's like, have you ever seen
which
this channel
videos?
Before?
Tell me which videos right now.
Yeah.
Your oldest publicly available video is a home movie titled Bonsai and the Stub, in which you and a friend sort of play the roles of 80s cops, would you say?
Something
like that, who chase down and punch members of the public who've dropped litter, which is, I think, one of my favorite examples of a YouTuber having uploaded something prior to realizing that they were going to be somewhat internet famous later down the line. I don't really have a question to ask about that one. I just wanted to mention it.
No, I will say it was a very conscious decision of, like, I had lots of videos on my channel that I did make private, but that one, I was like, that's staying up.
Great.
People have got to know where I came from.
I appreciate it. But anyway, your second oldest publicly available video is one that you've mentioned already, which is about Night in the Woods, Tacoma, and sort of the insidious, dehumanizing nature of capitalism. Your politics are clearly very left, and something I sometimes feel uncomfortable with, or at least I am at the moment, is the way in which being a YouTuber or a content creator or an influencer or whatever it is you want to call it, like, the whole setup sometimes feels like it's built around monetizing what you do and monetizing your audience in particular. Like, of course that's a vital part of doing the job and being able to, like, keep the light switched on and all the rest of it. But as our channels sort of steadily got bigger, I feel like we're having to avoid, like, more and more gross stuff. Like, some of the companies that email us wanting to sponsor our videos are just either weird or horrible. And then, like, YouTube itself wants you to push as many adverts as possible. And at least at one point, I remember, did you ever do the YouTuber Creator Academy?
No, thank God.
Yeah, well, you missed out on some good stuff. Like, at one point, they sort of teach you how to, develop your audience into something more like a cult. They actually use the word cult, I remember. And I suppose what I'm asking is, as someone with, like, anti-capitalist beliefs, how do you avoid becoming an exploitative YouTuber? Because it feels like a lot of the system pushes people in that direction. People I like, people whose politics I would guess I associate with, fall into some of these traps. And it's, yeah, something on my mind at the moment, just because more of them seem to be cropping up in for people making games right now.
Yeah, it's tough. This isn't an answer, but part of what I find difficult about it is that sometimes I think, like, you know, the way that I've always kind of made YouTube decisions is just like, what have the people that I liked done? You know, like, hey, you know, like, I'm a big fan of Patrick Willems. He does, you know, advertisements, so he does sponsorships at the end of his videos. I don't feel like he's selling out, and I've also kind of never been compelled to buy one, I guess. What's weird about making sponsorships is, on some level, I kind of hope that if people would find the thing useful already, then they'll get it, and that's great. And if they wouldn't, they won't be swayed by me saying it. But I know that's not the case, because I know that, like, they're paying to have this name that people trust say the things. And so that's hard, because I want my viewers to be as critical as they possibly can about everything. You know, yeah. that's what I'm doing, and they should be skeptical of me and of my motivations. And yeah, so it's hard. I don't know. I mean, I've been thinking about, you know, I've made the very conscious decision, like, not one taken lightly, to, like, have the amount of money that I make on Patreon shown, where you have the choice to either show just your number of patrons or the literal, like, dollar amount you're making. And the thing is, and this is not just kind of hearsay, there are literal, like, studies that you can read on it, that, like, if you hide the amount of money that you're making, you will make more. Mm-hmm. Just full stop. Like, it, you know, if people see 1,800 patrons, that reads differently to them than saying $6,500 per video or whatever.
True.
And I have been tempted many times to just flip that money off. But, like, you know, I've kind of thought, like, people, I don't know, there aren't that many hidden costs with what I do. I don't have to hire other people. You know, even People Make Games have multiple people on the payroll, and so that money is being split in different directions. But, like, for me, it's really all just go into me and the things that I need to make on a video. And so I think it's been a choice to be open and be like, if you think that this is enough, you know, like, that this is as much as I deserve, you're right. And if you think it's too much, I don't want to, like, hide that from you.
It's a weird thing to, that's exactly, like, in line with our choice to keep that open as well. And yeah, there's also another weird side of it, which makes me feel uncomfortable. I don't know if you necessarily experienced this in the same way, but Annie and I left a company that we used to work for in Brighton, a games media company, and we left it and launched the thing, and all of our old colleagues can, like, see how much we're earning from that, and, like, maybe some of them are wishing us more, wishing us well, and some were wishing us less well, I don't know, but, like, that, those numbers are there, like, when we were having good months or bad months, or if we were growing well or slowing down, like, it's uncomfortable, like, having that stuff, like, be public-facing, but the only reason we're doing it at the moment, and I don't know if I'll feel differently about this at some point down the line, is that it feels right to be transparent about that stuff and to like, give our audience the correct amount of information before they support us. Because I don't know how much you as a patron, how much you earn, like, what your responsibilities are. I don't want you being misled into thinking, like, we earn a certain amount and that's the reason why you're going to back us. Like, it feels right to have that publicly available, but it's really fucking weird. It's really weird.
Yeah, I mean, it's that kind of, this hump that I've needed to get over, where it's like, when I think kind of detached from myself ideologically, I'm like, well, everyone should know how much money everyone is making. You know, like, back at the company you worked for, it probably would have been better if everyone knew each other's salaries, because then, you know, it would aid negotiating. You would know how much your boss was making versus you. Like, that's all better. And so then there have been times when I've been like, okay, am I going to show, you know, how much I'm making or whatever? And yeah, it's this weird feeling of like, well, I shouldn't say that. And then I have to kind of go back and be like, why do I think that? You know, what is the reason that I have this kind of mental block here? And how do I get over it? And so it is, yeah, it's bizarre that most other jobs don't have this, you know, that our salaries are paid for by, you know, 1,000 people instead of one person. And all of those people can decide at any time, you're making too little money, you're making too much money, here's what I'm going to do. It's an immensely weird position to be in.
Yep.
But I do think it's, yeah, you know, like I want them to have as much knowledge as they can to make those decisions, you know, and like, I want people on my Patreon to know, like, if you leave, if you need to go, I'm going to be fine. Like, I'm going to be able to pay rent. I'm going to be able to eat. Like, you know, I don't want anyone to think that, like, I am fully reliant on them for my, you know, continued career. But also, you need them to think that you need money, because, like, ultimately, I do. Yeah. So it's... I don't have an answer for you, but I do think about it quite a bit.
Well, it's good. It, as you may have already noticed, you're one of a handful of other sort of similar YouTubers that I occasionally message on Discord with a panicked message about, like, hey, can you, like, how do you feel about this? Like, what's the right way to go about this strange situation that's come up with this job that I'm still struggling to understand?
Yeah, I mean, YouTube is the most... kind of, it's just everything is so predatory because it is made up of people who did not expect to be doing it for a job, you know, like the number of YouTubers who went into it thinking this is going to be how I make money versus the number of people like me who just accidentally had something go viral and then have had to like figure it out. You know, they're way more of me, and I never took any classes on like how to avoid getting scammed or how to make the right decisions or whatever. And so all you really have are, yeah, talking to other people about it.
Okay. Final question, and I'll let you go. The job that you have is a very aspirational one. What is your reality of that experience? Like, do you enjoy your job? Is it like what is it that people don't know about putting videos on YouTube for a living?
I mean, the answer is, yes, I do. I enjoy my job a lot. You know, like I am really happy being here. I feel like I am in such a unique position because not only can I make, you know, like enough from this to kind of have it be my job, but like I somehow got here with the stipulation that like I am going to write about whatever I want at all times, you know, that it's like, I'm not like a Dark Souls channel or a labor organizing channel or anything. It's just like, here are the things that are inside my head that I want to speak about. And that's very uncommon. So I guess that's one is like, I don't know, design freedom into what you're doing.
I feel like something you talked about earlier on is such a good point that like that you went viral at the right moment. It reminds me a little bit of, I watch a lot of TikTok, as everyone should, and the way in which that platform encourages you to repeat the same viral success if you find it over and over again is like, seems pretty soul destroying, to be honest. And the TikTok accounts that I feel have the best time with it and the most creative freedom are those that sort of manage to grow in the right way and establish what it is that they did prior to that one video that suddenly explodes. And so that, I guess, if people can take a lesson away from how to start a creatively sustainable video essay channel, wait until you're about 20 videos in until you find your huge viral success.
Yeah, then hit that big algorithm button and have YouTube shoot it off. Yeah, I mean, I think it's tough because, you know, you never want to tell someone to work for free, obviously. Like, you shouldn't do work and not get paid for it. However, I don't think you should go into YouTube with the assumption that it is work, you know, because if you can't enjoy it as a hobby, then I don't know. It seems like it's just going to be impossible to sustain. That I made a year of videos because of how much I enjoyed making those videos. And if you're kind of like every video you're hitting being like, boy, I hope this is the one that takes me to kind of profitability or whatever, it just seems like you're going to have a bad time. I don't know. YouTube is so oversaturated that like trying to game the system and figure out what people want to watch just kind of feels like a losing game versus like, what do I want to make? what do I want to put out into the world?
Jacob, thank you so much for being on the show. And it's so nice to chat to you. We don't like, although I do sometimes send you slightly agitated Discord messages from time to time, it's nice to actually spend an hour just chatting.
No, I have been a fan of your work for a long time and always thought in my little parasocial way, I bet Chris would be great to hang out with.
Oh, well, even if we had to make content around it, I appreciate it. And that's it for this month's episode. I hope you enjoyed it. If you'd like to support the Games Press and everything else we do, please head over to patreon.com/peoplemakegames. And as Jacob and I just mentioned, we're not hiding anything over there. So if you want to just take a look at how much PMG earns per month through the generous support of our audience, I should say, it's all right there in black and white. Maybe you think it's too much. Maybe you think it's not enough. Maybe you don't care. Those are all valid opinions. Thank you for listening.